Tracy Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose initiative on immigration, history, and policy presents World Migration and the Politics of Newness by Adam McCune on Monday, March 30th at noon at the Center for Advanced Study, 912 West Illinois in Urbana, online at www.cas.illinois.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible by Carle Foundation Hospital. Carle Foundation Hospital provided more than $80 million in community benefit last year, including almost $10 million in free or discounted care. More information about how Carle embraces its charitable mission is in its annual report at carle.org.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're also online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. Today we're going to take a look at the life of Abraham Lincoln through the lens of language and literature. Our guest is Fred Kaplan. His most recent book is Lincoln, the Biography of a Writer. This comes from the opening of Kaplan's biography of Lincoln. For Lincoln, words mattered immensely. His increasing skill in their use during his lifetime and his high valuation of their power mark him as the one president who was both a national leader and a genius with language at a time when its power and integrity mattered more than it does today. And Kaplan, riffing on the comment of a writer friend of Mark Twain, William Dean Howells, that Twain was the Lincoln of our literature, calls Lincoln the Twain of our politics. Fred Kaplan is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of English at Queens College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. The new book from Fred Kaplan, Lincoln, the Biography of a Writer, is published by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins. Fred Kaplan, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Nice to be with you.
A time when the power and integrity of language mattered more than it does today. A couple questions here to begin with. Why did it matter more, and why has language lost power and integrity?
It mattered more in Lincoln's lifetime, of course, as it did throughout the 19th century, because it was the only available tool for long-distance communication. If you wanted to speak to someone who you were not face-to-face with, of course, you had to do it in writing. No radio, no television, no computer, etc. So it mattered a great deal, and Lincoln grew up in a world in which language was the way in which people communicated at in every possible relationship and about every possible subject, the spoken language and, of course, the written language. This was true for political leaders as well as for just ordinary people, non-political people. And so, indeed, language had a sort of cultural cachet. That is, the written language and the spoken language had a cultural cachet that it can't possibly have today when we have electronic media, movies, visual impressions, the way in which people growing up in today's world experience the world. Presidents, well, that's, you know, another matter. Of course, the early presidents, those coming out of the colonial world, the time of the contemporary of the founding fathers, were part of an elite society. They were well educated, and they all learned to write using the classical canon of British writers of the 18th century and previously as their models. This kind of immersion in literature and in writing and in language has become attenuated, of course, in our modern culture. Of course, we all have a great reverence and respect for our language, and are eager to see it maintained in all its strength and versatility and viability, both in private life and in our literary culture, and especially in our public discourse. Mm. So we've come off 8 years of a president, whatever your view of his politics, who was not very effective either as a writer or a speaker. And we now have a president who has a mastery of the language that leads us to hope that it will give new vitality and serve as a model for respect for language, its importance in our culture, its honesty, its integrity, its plain speaking, its connection with reasoning and thinking. And so, you know, it's a complicated cultural and historical story.
Yeah, the president has two books on the bestseller list, Messages from My Father and The Audacity of Hope. What do these books tell us about Barack Obama as a writer?
Well, they tell us a great deal, of course, and Barack Obama is a new writer on the literary scene, if you will, and is a work in progress, but he is a fine writer who has a great respect for language, who is deeply familiar with the canon of British and American literature. He's read widely. He reads not only for practical purposes. He reads for self development and growth. Mm. So his language is not highly poetic. He's a different prose stylist than Lincoln was, of course. He has a spare and concise and a precise prose style. It has moments of lyricism in it. But it tells us a lot about him in terms of what he's willing to reveal and what he's committed to conceal. So his memoir, Dreams from My Father, is both a revealing and a concealing book. It's a highly focused memoir, of course, as we all know, dealing with the centrality of his discovering who he is, particularly in terms of his heritage and his race and how that fits into the American scene in an overall way. So the book is very good. It's not a great autobiography in the classical sense of Rousseau or St. Augustine or The Education of Henry Adams, but it's a really fine book.
Huh. Going back to the idea of self-development and growth, one of the things you have to say about Lincoln is that language was a tool for him that provided him with a way to better understand the world and a way for him to sort fact from fiction. How did these things help shape him as a man of politics?
It helped shape him as a man of politics because his lessons in understanding human nature came not only from his life, but from his reading. And his great literary models from early teenage years on were Shakespeare, Byron, Burns, the Bible in the St. James Version, Aesop's Fables, then to some extent Robinson Crusoe, and a number of anthologies of literature that he read that contained a wide variety of poetry and prose, and one of the poets he immensely admired was Alexander Pope. So this reading was entertained him. It thrilled him. He had an immediate identification with the beauty of the language. But this reading also, in shaping his sensibility, simultaneously shaped his mind. It gave him an immense respect for and models to emulate of the connection between effective writing, whether one is a writer or a reader of writing, and effective thinking. And early on, Lincoln developed a kind of steel trap of a mind, a great rational and logical feel for cause and effect, and for how the things of this world worked. Shakespeare probably was his lifelong favorite single author, and he learned from Shakespeare a great deal about human nature and human experience, the variety, the modulations, the differences. And among other things, he learned about the importance of listening, either as a reader or an auditor, really to what other people were saying, to listen to a variety, a large variety of voices, to be thoughtful and prudent in reaching conclusions, and always to look for the reconciliation, the middle way, bringing people together.
Yeah. Well, interesting, at the end of the book, you write about him as he's taking his second oath of office in March of 1865, and you say he uses biblical resonance and Shakespearean inclusiveness, to speak to a nation ripped apart by war.
One of the great talents that Lincoln had was for ways of addressing the needs of the nation in a language that was rich and resonant, but at the same time was accessible and direct, and a language steeped in voices that had a positive association to both North and South, like the Bible and Shakespeare. And to give his communication a sense, an additional sense of his feel for the complexity of the human situation and the need to see as many sides of the situation as there were, to be inclusive and to be harmonizing.
Mm. What did Lincoln have to say specifically about the power of language? What did he write or speak about in terms of the power of language?
Well, he wrote a brilliant lecture called Discoveries and Inventions, which, of course, I highlight in my book because it's fairly late in his life. It's all too short life, of course. It's 1859, and just before, of course, just after the Lincoln-Douglas debates, he's lost his bid to become the senator from Illinois, and just prior, of course, to the opening of his campaign to gain the Republican nomination for the presidency. And in that essay, he gives the highest primacy to writing as the invention that precedes all civilization. And I can actually quote him exactly for you. He says, "Writing, the art of communicating thoughts to the mind, to the eye, is the great invention of the world. Great in the astonishing range of analysis and combination, great, very great, in enabling us to converse with the dead, the absent, and the unborn at all distances of time and space, and great not only in its indirect benefits, but greatest help to all other inventions."
Hmm.
That's high praise indeed. I mean, it's more than high praise. It's a sense of, hey, first comes writing, then comes speaking. So writing precedes the reading or orating, if you will. And Lincoln was not a great orator, and he did not like to speak speak, extemporaneously. He did so up to a point and in a very controlled way when he was campaigning. And he had to give one speech after another, day in, day out, which essentially precedes his bid for the presidency, because in those days, once you became a nominee of one of the two major parties for the presidency, you didn't give any speeches in the pre-election period. That was sort of convention. It was beneath a potential president to go around and solicit votes. So you had surrogates doing that for you. But, of course, prior to that, in the Lincoln-Douglas debates and in his other political campaigns, he did a great deal of campaigning. He had sort of a set speech that had many different elements to it that he could slot in or slot out as he needed, which he had actually written at one time or another. So even when it seemed as if he was speaking extemporaneously, he usually was not. He had a tremendous memory. He lived in a culture in which memory was given much more emphasis than it is today, but nevertheless, still, even for his culture, he had a very effective memory. But however, whenever he possibly could, he always wrote out in its entirety everything he was going to say. He wanted to make sure he had every word down in writing. So for Lincoln, even in his practice as a public man, writing came before speaking.
One of the pieces of information that I found interesting early in the story of Lincoln's life is he's a boy, and he's memorizing portions of speeches of the statesman Henry Clay and reciting them, I don't know, to his friends, to whoever was around?
Whoever was around, to his immediate family, his sibling, his sister, and to the friends or group of kids who would be around the Lincoln house, cabin, and the farm. Yes, and the records seems to prove he would get up and on a little log, and after they came home from church, he was not an avid churchgoer. He had pious parents, but he himself was not in any traditional Christian sense a pious man, or even in any traditional sectarian Christian sense a believer. He would get up on the log, and he sometimes would repeat word for word what the preacher said, often with a comic tone or a satiric tone. He was very good at mocking and making fun of other folks. And he tried to wean himself from that when he saw that wasn't good for his political career. And he wrote satirical poetry and little satirical essays, apparently, though none of those survived. But yes, he would get up and he would orate. There were two sides to him. He was a very shy and private person on the one hand, but he also had a performance personality. If you put him on a stage to speak, he would warm up very quickly. And as a boy, he memorized speeches by Henry Clay and other politicians of the day he admired, and delivered them sort of in rehearsal for the career he knew or didn't know he was going to have.
Mm. Did he take the words of others, a person like Henry Clay, and write them down?
Not as far as the historians have been able to demonstrate. He did have a copybook as a young boy. Mm-hmm. It was a normal adjunct to the learning experience, to going to these little temporary schools that he went to for only very short periods of time. So he did write out some things in a copybook that clearly were not of his own invention. But that doesn't seem to have continued, and there's no record of a copybook the way we have for some colonial figures like, say, John Adams or Abigail Adams or John Quincy Adams, in which either in their diary or their copybooks they would copy out long extracts, and in fact, in their cases, long extracts from poets and prose writers they admired.
Yeah. You said a moment or two ago he wasn't a believer, yet when he might go to church with his family as a boy, he'd come home and he might recite mockingly, perhaps, some of the sermon that was given in church that day. Now, language and logic led him away from religion, yet he was a deist. And in the 1840s, this move away from religion proved a liability in his political career, as you alluded to a moment ago. How significant a liability was it, and how did he find his way out of that problem?
Well, it was a significant liability, and he almost lost an important election early in his career in Illinois because he was, and this is soon after his marriage in 1842 to Mary Todd, because he was thought of as both an elitist. Mary Todd's family was of a higher class than the general populace, if you will, and because he was thought of as an infidel, the word was infidel, used in a different way than we generally use it now. Lincoln's contemporaries meant by that word that he was not a Christian. So if you were a deist, you were an infidel. What did it mean to be a Christian? Well, at a minimum, you needed to believe in the divinity of Jesus and in the existence of the reality of miracle and in the existence of a soul that had that survived the body and had an everlasting life. And those were and it's those very things that Lincoln did not believe in. He was like Washington and like Lincoln and like Jefferson. He was a deist. He believed, as we all know, that there was that there is a creator God who sort of started everything and doesn't interfere anymore. And so there are no miracles here on earth. There are no superhuman beings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is, earth and human beings are subject to natural process, period. So it was a liability for Lincoln, and he backtracked is what he did. From early statements about and the statements that were spread by friends of his, some of whom wanted to protect him from the downside, political downside of these statements, he backtracked from his skeptical, deistic, rationalistic view, never embracing Christian religious belief, but making himself more parallel to the religious sensibility, which it was easy for him to do because he was so deeply immersed in the Bible. And since he was a deist and believed that there was a creator of all this, he could use language that had a religious and even a Christian resonance without identifying himself particularly as a Christian. He would go to church later on in life as president, only sporadically, but nevertheless he would make appearances. And this all served him very well when he became president because it allowed him to talk to an essentially Christian nation in a tone and drawing upon a common language that was reassuring and created a bond in the nation.
Hmm. I'm thinking now, too, here of maybe there are some parallels between Lincoln in this situation and Barack Obama. In terms of he had to distance himself from Jeremiah Wright, and yet as he becomes president, he moves to include other faiths and people of more conservative congregations.
Yes, I think there is a parallel. Indeed, there is. There is also an important difference. It's pretty clear that Barack Obama is a believing Christian on the fundamentalist side, who came to Christianity through a revelatory experience in which the emphasis was upon community. He went to that church and felt that the congregation had a spirit to it and a value to it. So, so Barack Obama, apparently, as he says in his writings, came to Christianity and to becoming a believing and practicing and church-going Christian through the importance of community to him. That's, I think, the best way I can put it. But the implication is, or the inference, I should say, is that he does share the theology of the Christian world that he is a participant in. However, he certainly sees it and practices it and speaks about it as an all-inclusive spirit rather than an exclusive theology or sectarian narrowness. He has an open embrace for the entire world and respect for every other religious belief or non-religious belief. Lincoln is different in the sense that he had this open embrace, but there's no evidence that he had a commitment to Christian theology.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Fred Kaplan. His most recent book is Lincoln, the Biography of a Writer. Fred Kaplan is Distinguished Professor Emeritus of English at Queens College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. A little more information about our guest. He's the author of 10 books and the editor of 5. His books include biographies of Mark Twain, Gore Vidal, Henry James, Charles Dickens, and Thomas Carlyle. His biography of Carlyle was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Pulitzer Prize. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener joining us now on the telephone from Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm just curious. Was Lincoln the great emancipator that we've come to learn over the years? Would he have fought to free the slaves if he could have saved the Union without doing that?
Well, of course, everything depends on what you mean by great in the phrase, the great emancipator. No question, he was the emancipator in the sense that he wrote and signed the Emancipation Declaration, which provided limited emancipation for Negroes. And it was a war document intended to play a role in the Union effort to defeat the Confederacy, and an expression of Lincoln's growing awareness that the black soldiers who were a part of the Union force and who were extremely valuable deserved the nation's commitment to emancipation. Lincoln was, for all his life, detested slavery, and there's lots of documents and evidence to support that. But he also revered the Constitution, and the Constitution had put into the founding document of the United States, slavery is a legal institution. Lincoln was in favor of the emancipation of all slaves. However, his commitment prior to the war and for the first year or two of the war was to that emancipation coming gradually over a period of time with compensation for slave owners who would be losing valuable property. And Lincoln's commitment was to the law on the one hand and morality on the other. The law was the Constitution. Morality said that slavery was an evil. How to put those two together, how to make those somehow reconciled, was a terribly difficult challenge, not only for him, but for all sorts of people of fundamental goodwill in the North and in the South. America then was a very racist country, both South and North, more so in the South, but very much so in the North. It was a complicated issue. The war made emancipation possible. Without it, would it have occurred? Well, one has to assume that it eventually would have, but one also has to think that it would have taken a much longer time.
Is the listener still there? You want to follow up?
Well, yes, in that it just seems to me, just listening the way he was brought up and his really not that religiously grounded, it suggests to me that if the war was not economically driven, and that's my belief, that it was driven because there were economies of scales in the South, namely slavery, that the South was benefiting on versus the North, I just wonder if it was more of economics than him being...
it's a very good point and an interesting one. And there's a lot of discussion by historians and experts on this subject, and you've read some of them also. Lincoln's parents, by the way, were pious Baptists of a very enthusiastic sort, and they were anti-slavery. It's an oddity that Lincoln himself, as a young boy, moved away from that, and worth noticing. There's no reason to think that in Lincoln's head, and from Lincoln's point of view, economics had anything to do with emancipating slaves or not emancipating slaves. In the larger picture of the conflict between North and South and the move and between slaveholders and those who were against slavery, economics was an issue. It was widely discussed. My sense of it is that modern historians, looking back on this, conclude that slavery was not a paying proposition in the South. And there's lots of contemporary evidence from the time by Southerners, by people who went down there and did studies, to show that the South was had a relatively primitive and poor economy. For, among other reasons, its use of slave labor rather than free labor, because free labor was much more efficient and much more effective, all these folks say, and modern historians seem to agree. So in some Southerners' minds, undoubtedly, there was an economic issue, that particularly for slave owners themselves, because each slave was worth X number of dollars, they just couldn't afford, they felt, to give that money away. But in terms of the larger picture, the view seems to be that an agricultural economy based on slaves was very economically inefficient.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other
interesting questions.
Other questions are invited. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. President Lincoln, Mr. Lincoln, before he was president, he wrote an awful lot of letters. People in that day did correspond a great deal. No text messaging. And one of the things that you write about him in terms of his correspondence is that he used correspondence to explore himself and his relationships with other people.
He did, and that wasn't intentional. That wasn't self-conscious on his part.
Oh, okay.
But in practice, one of the ways in which he could talk to others and talk to himself in a way that brought out his deepest thoughts and which allowed him then to rethink his feelings and his thoughts was through letters. Of course, lots of Lincoln's letters have been lost, especially from the early years when people weren't cherishing them. They were the way they were when he became a well-known figure. But it's particularly his correspondence with one of the people, one of the young women whom he fell in love with, a lady named Mary S. Owens, before he met Mary Todd, and to whom he proposed that reveal a lot about Lincoln, and that I look at closely in one of the chapters in which I talk about, write about, the three early loves of his life: Ann Rutledge, Mary Owens, and of course Mary Todd, whom he married. And there is a series of letters between himself and Mary Owens, and between Lincoln and a very good friend of his, Joshua Speed, mm-hmm. who was his sounding board and who also had similar challenges in regard to determining how he really felt about his relationship with a woman, his love, whether he really wanted to marry, what his fears were, his anxieties, concerns about sexuality, concerns about supporting a wife, and concerns simply about whether or not this was the desirable path to go down. And so Lincoln corresponded both with Mary Owens and with Joshua Speed, and those letters are wonderfully revealing about the three of them, but especially about Lincoln and the way in which he was using those letters to explore himself and define himself in terms of these personal issues.
Yeah. Besides the personal issues, were issues of the day worked out in these letters?
No, they were hardly at all. Lincoln's letters until he became a very prominent public figure, and especially in his presidency, Lincoln's letters before that time in his career are basically personal letters or business letters, a great number of business letters, of course, because of his career as a lawyer.
Hmm. One of the things that Lincoln wrote about, the dangers of demagoguery, maybe we need to talk about this before we're finished here today, because it is so clearly a problem that we have from time to time in our political discourse. What are your thoughts about political speech, the need for honesty, the need to lead, the need to get elected?
Lincoln was very aware, as we are now, of the potential and sometimes the real incompatibility between honest talk of a nuanced and substantive sort by a public figure, by a politician to his constituency, and the demands that an audience places on a speaker for, especially in our culture now, for sound bites, in effect, for being simplistic and reductive in order to create a sound bite that will be good for the TV evening news.
Mm-hmm.
Or
YouTube.
Or YouTube, indeed. Lincoln was a very careful and thoughtful speaker, wrote everything out in advance. He expected to have ample time to make his argument, make his point of view known, and provide evidence. Modern political leaders, alas, don't have that opportunity. Modern political leaders are also speaking, I'm not making a brief for them, but they're also speaking to a much bigger public than Lincoln was speaking to because of the changes in the size of the voting population, who's eligible to vote, and so on. So almost every contemporary politician to be successful has to be a populist up to a point, and a much greater point than Lincoln needed to be. And that means it's very tempting for a modern political leader to appeal very briefly, quickly, but strongly to the emotions, to the feelings, to the prejudices, to the biases, and to be a demagogue. Now, Lincoln prided himself on using language honestly and truthfully and transparently, saying what he meant, and providing everything relative to the argument he was going to make. And he frequently contrasted himself with his major opponent for a long time, culminating in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Stephen Douglas, who Lincoln saw, and I think we're looking back at the period, think of as a mid-19th century demagogue. He had many virtues, but as a speaker, his appeal was to the populace, the crowd, the mob. We don't like to use words like that anymore. We think of the voting public, everybody. But as we all, you know, recognize, everyone is not doesn't have the same patience to listen to an explanation or to follow to follow evidence. Everyone doesn't have the same education that allows them to understand beyond the simplest level. And human nature is such that we are all subject to being moved by and sometimes shortcutting rational thought when inflammatory language the kinds of speech that demagogues indulge in is directed at us. So this is, of course, something that we're all concerned about. And one of the refreshing things, if I may sort of close the circle a little bit, that Barack Obama has brought to the recent election campaign, and now he brings to the presidency, is the sense that he conveys of a thoughtful, meditative person who weighs his words, thinks about them carefully, who has a logical and rational mind, who is interested in hearing various opinions, and who will present us with the train of his argument and the logic that brings him to the conclusion, and he hopes to bring us along with him by that kind of rational process rather than by inflammatory language.
Hmm. To wrap up here, I want to get your thoughts on a populist, a skilled rhetorician from the land of Lincoln, our former governor. Have you been following the story? Have you seen him on the talk show circuit?
Only a hermit, deep in a cave, in an icy Arctic climate, could not know. The fame of your governor has spread far and wide. But it will disappear soon. He is a passing phenomenon. I wrote an op-ed piece for the Chicago Tribune that appeared just before the inaugural address, in which I talked about Obama as a citizen of Chicago who left without making a farewell speech. Lincoln made a farewell speech to the citizens of Springfield. George Washington made a farewell speech to the citizens of Alexandria, Virginia. Obama did not make a farewell speech. Obama, we all think and we all also hope, will be the image of Illinois and Illinois politics and Chicago politics that will more and more become that will erase the memory of your recent governor. And when Obama returns to Chicago 8 years from now, Chicago and Obama will be in everybody's mind, not the recent transient of an unfortunate event. Mm. I hope. Do you hope that, too?
I hope that, too.
Yes.
And we are in Illinois. Many of us are hoping that this will serve as an opportunity to get at some problems inherent in the political scene.
The underlying problems.
Yes.
And
yes.
We have people in Illinois and Chicago should remember that even though you have provided us with some blatant examples, this is nationwide. And it's the corruption of political office, a structural corruption of our politics and our public life. And it's a structural corruption based in the fact that politicians, when they come into office these days, whatever the state of their bank accounts, almost always leave wealthy people, which is terrible to behold. We've had just a recent example of it with a very fine public servant, Tom Daschle, who in a brief period of time after leaving the Congress earned $5 million. This is not good. And this is a nationwide problem that we really ought to do something about.
Yeah. And perhaps as part of that, we could look more seriously, study more seriously language and literature.
I hope so.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Fred Kaplan, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Fred Kaplan's most recent book is Lincoln, The Biography of a Writer. The book is published by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins. And that interview was from February 4th of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frain is our technical director today. It's 1:52 Central Time, 58 degrees in Urbana. Standing by now with settlement prices from Chicago and Kansas City, Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was a pretty tough day at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City, with prices certainly coming to the downside, beans, double-digit losses there, but still higher on the month. We'll have to discuss the implications of today's trade at 2:06 with Mike Zuzolo of Risk Management Commodities on the closing market report. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars in Kansas City. May wheat, a high on the day of 560 and three quarters, a low of 546 and three quarters, settling 550 down 10. July, a high of 662. A low of 557 and a quarter, settling 560 and a half down 10 and a quarter. May wheat at the Board of Trade, a high of 517 and a half, a low of 503, settling 507 and a quarter, down 7 and a quarter. July, a high of 530, a low of 515 and a half, settling 520, down 7. December, a high of 579, a low of 564 and three quarters, settling 569 and a half, down 6 and three quarters. July of 2010, a high of $6, a low of 589, settling 594, down 6.5. May corn, a high of 390 and three quarters, a low of 385, settling 387, down 3.75. May losing 9.5 cents on the week. July, a high of 401, a low of 395.5, settling 397.5, down 3.75. December corn, a high of 422 and three quarters, a low of 417 and a quarter, settling 419 and a quarter, down 3.5. Take it out to March of 2010, a high of 435, a low of 429.5, settling 432, down 3.5. July, a high of 445 and a quarter, a low of 442 and a quarter, settling 444 and a half, down 2.5. May oats, a high of 196 and three quarters, a low of 191 and a half, settling 195 and a half, down 1.5. The July contract also off 1.5 on the day. The high there, 207 and three quarters, the low 201, settling 204. May beams, a high of 948 and three quarters, a low of 916, settling at 917, down 27 on the day and down 35 on the week. July, a high of 945, a low of 914 and a half, settling 915 and a quarter, down 25 and a quarter. September beams, a high of 885 and three quarters, a low of 872 and a quarter, settling 871 and three quarters, down 21 and a quarter. November, a high of 887, a low of 860 and a quarter, settling 860 and three quarters, down 19 and three quarters. Let's go out to March of 2010, a high of 890, a low of 891 and three quarters, settling 879 and a half, down 19. July of 2010, a high of $9 and a half, a low of 897, settling 891 and three quarters, down 20 and one quarter. November of 2010, a high of 912, a low of 890, settling 889 and three quarters, down 18 and three quarters. May soybean meal, a high of 292.20, a low of 283.50, settling 283.80, down $7. July, a high of 287.70, a low of 279.40, settling 279.90, down $6.10. May soybean oil, a high of 33.65, a low of 32.38, settling 32.42, down 118. July, a high of 33.93, a low of 32.65, settling 32.72, down 116 on the day. Remember, we have a hogs and pigs report that's coming up at 2 o'clock, so we'll have that hot off the press when we have the closing market report as well. We'll have CME livestock numbers, the closing settlements in just a moment. This is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Now let's turn our attention to the livestock contracts and how they fared today in Chicago. A lower day today for the majority of the contracts that we follow. April live cattle, 84.75, the high, 84.25, the low. The settlement, 84.32 and a half, that up a nickel. June, 82.30, the high, 81.55, the low, 81.57 and a half, the settlement, that down 27 and a half. August, 83, even, the high, 82.45, the low, 82.52 and a half, the settlement, that down 15. October, 86 even, the high, 86.02 and a half, the low, the settlement, 86.17 and a half, down 12 and a half. April feeder cattle, 93.80, the high, 92.85, the low, 93.12 and a half, the settlement, that down 30. May, 95.10, the high, 94.02 and a half, the low, 94.30, the settlement, down 65. August, 97.85, the high, 96.70, the low, 96.90, the settlement, that down 55. September, 98.45, the high, 97.50, the low, 97.72 and a half, the settlement, that down 62 and a half. April lean hog, 60.75, the high, 60.20, the low, the settlement, 60.47 and a half, that down a nickel. May, 71.57 and a half, the high, 70.80, the low, 71.20, the settlement, that down 37 and a half. June, 72.20, today's high, the low 71, the settlement 71.40, down 37 and a half. July lean hog, 73.05, the high 72.35, the low 72.40, the settlement, that down 30. May bellies finished up today, 85.95, the high, 85 even, the low, the settlement 85.90, that up 90 cents. The Dow is currently off 134 at 77.91. The NASDAQ off 34 at 15.53. The S&P 500 is off 14 at 8.19. Crude oil, nearby month, trading in New York, down 199. Make that 198 at 52.36. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Coming up today on The World from PRI, Turkey's mostly Muslim voters go to the polls this weekend. Candidates for local office include Jews, Armenians, and a transvestite. Never before have so many non-traditional politicians been on the ballot. Some Turks are calling it democratization. Others say it's a government ploy to curry favor with the European Union. Turkish elections, that story in the day's news coming up today on The World at 3 o'clock. It's 2 o'clock Central Time, 59 degrees.